Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It has been 45 years since the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald. But those who experienced the weekend's shocking events firsthand tend to remember them as if they were yesterday, especially those who reported the assassinations to North Texas and the rest of the world.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's a man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn.
Oswald
has been shot.
Moving down now into the basement. Here comes the ambulance. And Oswald will be removed now. The ambulance is being pulled up in front of us here.
Unbelievable.
Here comes Oswald. He is ashen and unconscious at this time, now being moved in. He's not moving. He's in the ambulance now, and attendants, police are quickly climbing in. They're now having to remove the armored truck.
That was Bob Huffaker, you saw and heard reporting there. He and Bill Mercer were among those intrepid journalists who helped pioneer a new era of broadcast news coverage. They write about it along with George Phoenix and Wes Wise in the book When the News Went Live, Dallas, 1963. Bob, Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks
Thank
for being
you,
here,
Chris.
So, Bob, we saw you there at the Oswald shooting. That was just one more incredibly shocking event in a weekend where it must have seemed that the trauma would not stop.
It did seem like just an unending nightmare. And it began with feelings of just desolation and tragedy, especially the scene at Parkland Hospital immediately following the motorcade. Suddenly, I found myself there, and it was the saddest scene I ever saw, or certainly ever reported. And then the Oswald shooting was just one more dreamlike thing going on. Afterward, we hardly could believe what we had been through.
And there were such complex emotions, Bill, even mm-hmm. going into the weekend, before anything went wrong. Can you talk a little bit about the mood and what people were thinking and the energy of the city?
We were doing a program on radio, but interview program called Comment during about 60, 61, 62, 3. And we had the, because of the pulse of the community, at least part of the community, and there were some vicious people. There were some absolute untrustworthy people out there. And we had every one of them on that program. And it was a different kind of interview program, not like talk radio today. But we had this feeling that something was going to happen. I was teaching a night course at North Texas. And I was driving home Thursday night, and I thought, I hope nothing happens to Mara to make Kennedy embarrassed. I thought maybe a rock or eggs thrown at his caravan. So we were concerned that he might be embarrassed. No thought to expand it to being shot or anything. But there were people we knew who would try to embarrass him. And that was my great fear.
And Bob, before you were at the hospital, you were there along the parade route, and you actually saw the motorcade pass by and felt like all of the worries were unnecessary.
I was delighted to see that the welcome downtown was spectacular. Yeah. It seemed as though the whole town had turned out. And when the motorcade passed, people were so enthusiastic to have seen their president and his gorgeous wife. This beautiful couple passing in a glittering limousine, and then the following immediately when the last press buses headed out toward the toward Dealey Plaza and death, the crowd surged out into the street and followed them, just in jubilation followed the motorcade down the street. I went on talking. I was doing a kind of a political wrap-up. And so the shots were fired while I was still talking. And I had expressed a great deal of relief in that broadcast that things had gone well. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I had, in light of history, I was speaking too soon.
I have looked at a lot of this old footage, and I saw and heard an amazing film of both of you sort of holding it together. How do you set aside, as an American, as a Texan, as a Dallasite at the time, how do you set aside your emotions in order to keep going through something that has everyone else frozen in time?
You know, that was, we've talked about that. We were pretty good journalists at the time. We had a certain amount of background. And this thing happened, and we were working on instinct. I was at the third floor that night, Friday night. We had a camera, live camera, for the first time. But I had no floor man, I had no director, I had no bug in my ear. It was all do it. And it was kind of the instinct to go interview the district attorney, find the cops that we knew, watch Oswald as he kind of... It was just working kind of on adrenaline and hoping that we were doing the job. And I know we just had to look at things and say, that's a story, that's a person we have to talk to. I never thought about anything... And actually, the assassination of Kennedy was kind of pushed aside to do this job in the third floor and then go down to the press conference with Lee Harvey. And
such a bizarre event.
Oh, and so totally out of control. The poor Dallas police thought they were doing us a favor, but we had these yelling, screaming reporters, and nothing could happen. And that's when I kneeled down in front of Oswald, and the guy next to me asked him, have you been charged with anything? And he said, no. And that's when I had just found out that he had and said, yes, you've been charged with the death of the president. My one moment of speaking to Mr. Oswald. So, but you just, I don't know why I said that to him, but it was that thing to do. And then he turned and walked out. That's the last time I saw him.
Obviously, from watching the old footage, there was access to everything, but it yep. was sort of chaos. There were reporters everywhere. How long did it take for the city to be overrun with people from the rest of the world wanting to get in on this story?
Hours.
Well, it certainly didn't take very many hours. Every plane that landed at Love Field had reporters on it. And in this hallway up in the third floor of Dallas Police Headquarters, the chaos became more and more recognizable as chaos.
Fist fights in some cases?
Shoving.
No fist fights that I actually witnessed, but there was a lot of shoving. And a number of the reporters were just voracious in their desire to
win a Pulitzer.
Win a Pulitzer or something like that. And they were over-eager, I would say, and less thoughtful than I wanted them to be. I remember at one time I had found myself interviewing Jim Underwood, my colleague, who had been the one who brought Ruby's sister up to the police station.
He was the weatherman, right?
He did our weather, and he was also our assistant news director. And a dear heart who had simply brought Eva Grant into the station. And so all the reporters mobbed Jim, and I was one of them, interviewing my own colleague with a microphone that was live on CBS. And at one point, in fact, only two of us had a live feed, and that was CBS and NBC. Seldom did ABC have one at the police station. But I was standing there in this awkward position of interviewing my own colleague about his having brought Eva Grant to the police station. And one of the reporters from LA, I believe, who was standing next to me with just a little tape recorder, and I with a live CBS mic, this fellow asked Jim what Eva Grant's address was. And the city had been plagued with bomb threats to media outlets and that sort of thing over the last couple of days, and I was quietly horrified to hear him asking this woman's address on my live television. So I said quietly to Jim, would you mind not answering that question just yet? And the fellow next to me pulled his mic back and said, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Huffaker of KRLD has just stopped Jim Underwood of KRLD from answering my question. And I finally just took the microphone, live or not, and set it down, or brought it down, and said, if you want to get someone killed again, then do it with your own mic, not mine.
It's alarming how much those few days really absolutely reflected what was to come. This environment that many people today think is out of control, with media mm-hmm. sort of everywhere in every corner of life. Did you both think that weekend, were you able to process on that level that this was it, this was the future, and you were there on the very first days of it?
I don't think I thought much about the future. We just thought every day by day by day, at least I did. And you just went out and did something, you know. Later, we started thinking about how this had impacted television, and that we were, and that being live was really amazing. And then later on, it really took off. But I didn't think about it at the time. You may have. You're brighter than I am.
I could not think about it. It was like one continuing nightmare. Mm-hmm. And I do remember the very first day when I arrived at Parkland and hopped the car over the curb to get my radio set up back close to the emergency room. I did have presence of mind to tell our studios to please tape everything that we were doing. And that's as far as I could think ahead in future.
You know, being up there in the third floor, I didn't know what was happening outside of there. I didn't know if they were taping. I didn't know if I was talking to anybody in New York. I didn't care. My whole focus was on the person I was trying to see and find. And that's kind of the way we did it.
And we should remind people, you know, we take live television so much for granted now. It's easy. It takes, you know, 3 minutes to set something up. It was a huge effort then. And if you had filmed something, you would actually have to get it back to the station and process it before you could even think about putting it on the air.
Right. Yeah. We had no cell phones. We had no direct line to our station by audio, except by the little microphones in the cars that we had.
Two-way radios. Sort of.
Two-way radios. We did all film and sound film, and that all, as you said, had to be processed. We had to write it or ad-lib it if we went right on the air. It was a process. It took a long time. We thought we were doing it pretty fast. Wes Wise shot the film of Stevenson being hit week before.
With a sign on it.
With a sign. And those guys ran that back to the station, processed it, and had it on the 10 o'clock in about a period of about 30, 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then our news anchor ad-libbed the story beautifully. So that was the kind of thing we were always rushing around. And now you've got satellite and you can do it instantaneously. So it was a different period.
You know, as an example, that had happened, that Stevenson embarrassment had happened 1 month almost exactly to the day before the president's visit. And it provided one good example of the fact that up until November 22nd, television was not really thought of among us all as something that you broadcast news live from the scene on. It only began on November 22nd, because that previous month, even when the disruption was taking place during Ambassador Stevenson's address here in Dallas, there was a scuffle down on the floor in front of the ambassador as he spoke. And our directors, rather than focusing the cameras on that as news, had the cameraman tilt up and stay away from the ugly scene that was going on. So we didn't get that on live. It was an organized political speech, and only later did we come to go live.
As awful as it was to be there at that time, I have to wonder if there's a sense that nothing else in your journalistic careers would ever compare with that weekend.
Nothing. Nothing. And I'd been at KRLD 10 years, and I was doing sports and news because we doubled up on everything over there. We were this amazing
cheap cooking, bottle washing.
Yeah, everything. Mm-hmm. And here we are thrust into this thing suddenly. And it was, as we said, it was just a matter of I'm going to do this and I'm going to try to do it well. But I had, I don't know, there was nothing there that we could lay a hand on, was there? I mean, just there was a story there somewhere.
And we had to just keep going when we were on the air. We had to just keep repeating what we knew.
Yeah.
Because we knew that there were people tuning in late, and many of them didn't know what was happening, especially on that first terrible day. And we knew that we had to keep updating them and repeating ourselves.
And we couldn't talk to anybody back at the station.
It's still, to this day, really an amazing achievement. I thank you both so much for being here.
Oh, we thank you for having us back.
It's a pleasure.
We'll be back in 5 years.
Excellent. Bill Mercer and Bob Huffaker are two co-authors of the book When the News Went Live, Dallas, 1963. Just ahead on Think, Dallas's oldest continuous-running professional dance troupe prepares a holiday gift for fans. We'll hear from the founder of the Dallas Black Dance Theater right after this week's Arts Calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend includes Edward Albee, the pioneer of video art, and A View from the Canyon. Opening at the Conduit, you have a trio of new shows, including the Small Works Group Show, Dallas artist Mary Emma Hawthorne's Africa, and Kenneth Holder's Views of Copper Canyon, in the show Then and Now, works on paper from 1972 to 2008. The Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth celebrates their first ever video installation, Mary Lucier's Plains of Sweet Regret, a study of the Upper Midwest's dwindling population commissioned by the North Dakota Museum of Art. For the fans of Edward Albee, make your way to the Mac in Dallas for Kitchen Dog Theater's production of The Goat, or Who is Sylvia?, a riotous examination of matters of the heart and the limits of tolerance. And the Endermain Theater kicks off their run of Sarah Rule's Eurydice, a reworking of the myth of Orpheus, as told by his loving wife from the land of the dead. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
How can North Texas attract and keep world-class performers? For 32 years, the Dallas Black Dance Theater has brought dancers together to perform modern, jazz, ethnic, and spiritual works. And founder and artistic director Ann Williams is here to talk about the group's remarkable impact. Ann, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So in its history, the Dallas Black Dance Theater has performed for 2.5 million people. What does that number mean to you when you think about it?
Well, it means great exposure, and hopefully that it will continue. That's one of the real things, and it means that Dallas Black Dance Theater draws on a lot of passion, passion for dance and passion for spreading the arts and showing off these young, beautiful dancers that we have.
40,000 in that audience have been children, and it must be amazing to go before a group of kids that haven't been exposed to really great dance before.
And many of them have never seen art as artistic expression, you know, and really dance as an art form. And as you said, some of them were able to see people on stage that looked like them, you know, and they wanted to know how did they do that? How did they get so high with their leaps and their legs go up? And because before that, a lot of them thought dance was just a natural thing that they were able to do. And so when we go in and perform for those kids, then we teach them about the training and about the self-esteem that dance does for them and that it is an art form. It's like math. You have to do that over and over and over and over again, and there are stages until you can get to that point. And they understand.
What is the audition process like?
For the dancers, it is. We have dancers that come from throughout the United States, and it's held in July of each year. And, of course, the auditorium or the theater can be filled with as many as 35 dancers that come, and we might only have a position for one dancer. And so it's sometimes it's kind of sad because, you know, there's an effort that's made and then a real effort on our part for choosing the best person that will fit Dallas Black Dance Theater. But we give them a series of ballet and modern movement. And, of course, now, with the economy being like it isn't all just the artistic expression. I have to really know that their heads are ready and that mm-hmm. they can fit into the Dallas Black Dance Theater and into our mission, because you get the wrong dancer to close a company in a minute, you know.
Yeah, and
So that is a lot of the part of dance company auditions now. And not only Dallas Black Dance Theater, but other companies too. Really getting that dancer, not only that's good, because a lot of time we can help train them, but we also want one that has a clean mind and a clean head.
How has the audience changed for the work that you do in 32 years?
It has become, I would say, more diverse for Dallas Black Dance Theater. And because we are a contemporary modern dance company, we see a lot of people that leave our shows and leave our performances really wanting to come back and really wanting more. Everybody's saying it's too short, you know, after we will have danced for 2 hours, you know. But mainly because Dallas Black Dance Theater being a repertory dance company, we dance for the audience. And so the themes that we have now and the music that we have now is very contemporary. So they can understand what's going on stage, even if they do not know all the movement. They get the feeling that the dancers have and the motifs that they're trying to portray. So that's always great.
You do this amazing thing every year, this holiday program. It's
yes.
3-day lunch series. Can you
yes.
talk about that?
It's going on beginning Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. It's called our Noontime Performances, Behind the Scenes. You have an opportunity to come from 12 until 1 to watch the dances in a very intimate expression and session, see what they are doing very up close. And we'll preview some of the dances that we will do perhaps in February for our cultural awareness series. A couple of works that we're working on, I'll come out and talk about those pieces. Give them an opportunity after the performance to come up and shake hands with the dancers and ask the dancers questions. It's always a very, very warm and wonderful experience. And let me tell you, we started out trying to do that to invite new customers and new people in. And we wait around and the new don't come, so now all the friends come. So people do have to call and reserve a seat, because other than that, we can only serve so many because we're in our large studio. And if the new ones don't come, then the old ones are there, the friends are there, and it's always full.
Do you have a favorite style of dance that you just love to see the company doing?
Modern. Mm-hmm. Lyrical modern, which really moves. It's kind of different from the Graham style, because with a hardened technique is what we do. And in lyrical dance, you see the dancers move all over the stage, which means they cover that area.
Beautiful stuff. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Dallas Black Dance Theater will host its Behind the Scenes holiday series at its Arts District Studios November 24th through the 26th. Admission is free, but you do need to make reservations in order to attend. You can go to the Think page of KERA.org for links to free podcasts of our TV show and our radio show. And we do welcome your comments always to think@KERA.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.